George R. R. Martin, A Night at the Tarnhouse. Hugo, Nebula, and World Fantasy Award winner George R. R. Martin, New York Times best-selling author of the landmark A Song of Ice and Fire fantasy series, has been called the American Tolkien. Born in Bayonne, New Jersey, George R. R. Martin made his first sale in 1971 and soon established himself as one of the most popular science fiction writers of the 70s. He quickly became a mainstay of the Ben Bova analog with stories such as With Morning Comes Mistfall and Seven Times Never Kill Man, The Second Kind of Loneliness, The Storms of Windhaven, in collaboration with Lisa Tuttle, and later expanded by them into the novel Windhaven, Override, and others. Although he also sold to Amazing, Fantastic, Galaxy, Orbit, and other markets. One of his analog stories, the striking novella A Song for Leah, won him his first Hugo Award in 1975. By the end of the 70s, he had reached the height of his influence as a science fiction writer and was producing his best work in that category, with stories such as the famous Sand Kings, his best-known story, which won both the Nebula and the Hugo in 1980. He'd later win another Nebula in 1985 for his story, Portraits of His Children. The Way of Cross and Dragon, which won a Hugo Award in the same year, making Martin the first author ever to receive two Hugo Awards for fiction in the same year. Bitter Blooms, The Stone City, Star Lady, and others. These stories would be collected in Sand Kings, one of the strongest collections of the period. By now, he had mostly moved away from analog, although he would have a long sequence of stories about the droll interstellar adventures of Haviland Tuff, later collected in Tuff Voyaging, running throughout the 80s in the Stanley Schmidt analog, as well as a few strong individual pieces such as the novella Night Flyers. Most of his major work of the late 70s and early 80s, though, would appear in Omni. The late 70s and 80s also saw the publication of his memorable novel, Dying of the Light, his only solo science fiction novel, while his stories were collected in A Song for Leah, Sand Kings, Songs of Stars and Shadows, Songs the Dead Man Sing, Night Flyers, and Portraits of His Children. By the beginning of the 80s, he'd moved away from science fiction and into the horror genre, publishing the big horror novel Fever Dream, and winning the Bram Stoker Award for his horror story, The Pear-Shaped Man, and the World Fantasy Award for his werewolf novella, The Skin Trade. By the end of that decade, though, the crash of the horror market and the commercial failure of his ambitious horror novel, Armageddon Rag, had driven him out of the print world and to a successful career in television instead, where for more than a decade he worked as story editor or producer on such shows as New Twilight Zone, and Beauty and the Beast. After years away, Martin made a triumphant return to the print world in 1996, with the publication in 1996 of the immensely successful fantasy novel A Game of Thrones, the start of his Song of Ice and Fire sequence. A freestanding novella taken from that work, Blood of the Dragon, won Martin another Hugo Award in 1997. Further books in the Song of Ice and Fire series, A Clash of Kings, A Storm of Swords, A Feast for Crows, and A Dance with Dragons, forthcoming, have made it one of the most popular, acclaimed, and best-selling series in all of modern fantasy. His most recent books are a massive retrospective collection spanning the entire spectrum of his career, GRRM, a retrospective, a novella collection, Star Lady and Fast Friend, a novel written in collaboration with Gardner Dozoy and Daniel Abraham, Hunter's Run, and, as editor, two new volumes in his long-running Wild Cards anthology series, Wild Cards, Busted, Flush, and Wild Cards, Inside Straight. Here he takes us to the land of the Falling Wall, through a haunted forest and across a bleak and desolate tarn, for a dangerous and surprising night of hospitality at the Tarn House, famous for their hissing eels, in company with a strange and varied cast of colorful characters, none of whom are even remotely what they seem. A Night at the Tarn House, George R. R. Martin. Through the purple gloom came Molokos, the melancholy, borne upon an iron palanquin by four dead Diadans. Above them hung a swollen sun where dark continents of black ash were daily spreading across dying seas of dim red fire. Behind and before the forest loomed, steeped in scarlet shadow. 7 feet tall and black as onyx, the Diadans wore ragged skirts and nothing else. The right front Diadant, fresher than the others, squished with every step. Gaseous and swollen, his ripening flesh oozed noxious fluid from 1,000 pinpricks where the excellent prismatic spray had pierced him through. His passage left damp spots upon the surface of the road, an ancient and much overgrown track whose stones had been laid during the glory days of Thorsengull, now a fading memory in the minds of men. The Diadans moved at a steady trot, eating up the leagues. Being dead, they did not feel the chill in the air, nor the cracked and broken stones beneath their heels. The palanquin swayed from side to side, a gentle motion that made Molokos think back upon his mother, rocking him in his cradle. Even he had had a mother once, but that was long ago. The time of mothers and children had passed. The human race was fading, whilst grues and herbs and pelgrains claimed the ruins they left behind. To dwell on such matters would only invite a deeper melancholy, however. Molokos preferred to consider the book upon his lap. After 3 days of fruitless attempts to commit the excellent prismatic spray to memory once again, he had set aside his grimoire, a massive tome bound in cracked vermilion leather with clasps and hinges of black iron, in favor of a slender volume of erotic poetry from the last days of the Sherrett Empire, whose songs of lust had gone to dust eons ago. Of late, his gloom ran so deep that even those fervid rhymes seldom stirred him to tumescence, but at least the words did not turn to worms wriggling on the vellum, as those in his grimoire seemed wont to do. The world's long afternoon had given way to evening, and in the dusk even magic had begun to crack and fade. As the swollen sun sank slowly in the west, the words grew harder to discern. Closing his book, Molokos pulled his cloak of fearsome mien across his legs and watched the trees go past. With the dying of the light, each seemed more sinister than the last, and he could almost see shapes moving in the underbrush, though when he turned his head for a better look, they were gone. A cracked and blistered wooden sign beside the road read, "Tarn House, half a league on, famous for our hissing eels." An inn would not be unwelcome, although Molokos did not entertain high expectations of any hostelry that might be found along a road so drear and desolate as this. Come dark, grues and herbs and leucomorphs would soon be stirring, some hungry enough to risk an assault even on a sorcerer of fearful mien. Once he would not have feared such creatures. Like others of his ilk, it had been his habit to arm himself with 6 puissant spells whenever he was called up to leave the safety of his manse. But now the spells ran through his mind like water through his fingers, and even those he still commanded seemed feebler each time he was called upon to employ them. And there were the shadow swords to consider as well. Some claimed they were shape-changers with faces malleable as candle wax. Molokos did not know the truth of that, but of their malice he had no doubt. Soon enough he would be in Cain, drinking black wine with Princess Candleloom and his fellow sorcerers, safe behind the city's tall white walls and ancient enchantments. But just now, even an inn, as dreary as this tarn house, must surely be preferable to another night in his pavilion beneath those sinister pines. Slung between 2 towering wooden wheels, the cart shook and shuddered as it made its way down the rutted road, bouncing over the cracked stones and slamming Chimwazzle's teeth together. He clutched his whip tighter. His face was broad, his nose flat, his skin loose and sagging and pebbly with a greenish cast. From time to time, his tongue flickered out to lick an ear. To the left, the forest loomed, thick and dark and sinister. To the right, beyond a few thin trees and a drear gray strand dotted with clumps of salt grass, stretched the tarn. The sky was violet, darkening to indigo, spotted by the light of weary stars.
Faster,
Chimwazzle called to Polymumpho in the traces. He glanced back over his shoulder. There was no sign of pursuit, but that did not mean the Twik men were not coming. They were nasty little creatures, however tasty, and clung to their grudges past all reason.
Dusk falls. Soon night will be upon us. Bestir yourself. We must find shelter before evenfall, you great lump.
The hairy-nosed pooner made no reply but a grunt, so Chimwazzle gave him a lick of the whip to encourage his efforts.
Move those feet, you verminous lout!
This time, Polymumpho put his back into it, legs pumping, belly flopping. The cart bounced, and Chimwazzle bit his tongue as one wheel slammed against a rock. The taste of blood filled his mouth, thick and sweet as moldy bread. Chimwazzle spat, and a gobbet of greenish phlegm and black ichor struck Polymumpho's face and clung to his cheek, before dropping off to spatter on the stones.
Faster!
Chimwazzle roared, and his lash whistled a lively tune to keep the pooner's feet thumping. At last the trees widened, and the inn appeared ahead of them, perched upon a hummock of stone where three roads came together. Stoutly built and cheery it seemed, stone below and timber higher up, with many a grand gable and tall turret and wide windows through which poured a warm, welcoming, ruddy light, and the happy sounds of music and laughter, accompanied by a clatter of cups and platters that seemed to say, "Come in! Come in! Pull off your boots, put up your feet, enjoy a cup of ale." Beyond its pointed rooftops, the waters of the tarn glittered smooth and red as a sheet of beaten copper, shining in the sun. The great Chimwazzle had never seen such a welcome sight.
"Halt!"
he cried, flicking his whip at Polymumpho's ear to command the pooner's attention.
"Stop! Cease! Here is our refuge."
Polymumpho stumbled, slowed, halted. He looked at the inn dubiously and sniffed.
"I would press on if I were you."
"You would like that, I'm sure."
Chimwazzle hopped from the cart, his soft boots squishing in the mud.
"And when the Twik men caught us, you would chortle and do nothing as they stabbed at me. Well, they never will find us here."
"Except for that one," said the pooner.
And there he was, a Twik man, flying bold as you please around his head. The wings of his dragonfly made a faint buzzing sound as he couched his lance. His skin was a pale green, and his helm was an acorn shell. Chimwazzle raised his hands in horror.
"Why do you molest me? I have done nothing."
"You ate the noble Florindal,"
the Twik man said.
"You swallowed Lady Melisence and devoured her brothers three."
"Not so. I refute these charges. It was someone else who looked like me. Have you proof? Show me your proof." "What? Have you none to offer? Begone with you, then."
Instead, the Twik man flew at him and thrust his lance point at his nose. But quick as he was, Chimwazzle was quicker. His tongue darted out, long and sticky, plucked the tiny rider from his mount, pulled him back, wailing. His armor was flimsy stuff and crunched nicely between Chimwazzle's sharp green teeth. He tasted of mint and moss and mushroom. Very piquant. Afterward, Chimwazzle picked his teeth with the tiny lance.
"There was only the one,"
he decided confidently when no further Twik men deigned to appear.
"A bowl of hissing eels awaits me. You may remain here, pooner. See that you guard my cart."
Lirianne skipped and spun as on she walked, lithe and long-legged, boyish and bouncy, clad all in gray and dusky rose. She had a swagger in her step. Her blouse was spun of spider silk, soft and smooth, its top three buttons undone. Her hat was velvet, wide-brimmed, decorated with a jaunty feather and cocked at a rakish angle. On her hip, Tickle Me Sweet rode in a sheath of soft gray leather that matched her thigh-high boots. Her hair was a mop of auburn curls, her cheeks dusted with freckles across skin as pale as milk. She had lively gray-green eyes, a mouth made for mischievous smiles, and a small upturned nose that twitched as she sniffed the air. The evening was redolent with pine and sea salt, but faintly, beneath those scents, Lirianne could detect a hint of herb, a dying grew, and the nearby stench of ghouls. She wondered if any would dare come out and play with her once the sun went down. The prospect made her smile. She touched the hilt of Tickle Me Sweet and spun in a circle, her boot heels sending up little puffs of dust as she whirled beneath the trees.
"Why do you dance, girl?"
a small voice said.
"The hour grows late, the shadows long. This is no time for dancing."
A quick man hovered by her head, another just behind him. A third appeared, then a fourth. Their spear points glistened redly in the light of the setting sun, and the dragonflies they rode glimmered with a pale green luminescence. Lirianne glimpsed more amongst the trees, tiny lights darting in and out between the branches, small as stars. "The sun is dying," Lirianne told them. "There will be no dances in the darkness. Play with me, friends. Weave bright patterns in the evening air whilst still you can."
"We have no time for play,"
one twig man said.
"We hunt," another said. "Later we will dance."
"Later,"
the first agreed, and the laughter of the twig men filled the trees as sharp as shards.
"Is there a twig town near?" asked Lirianne.
"Not near,"
one twig man said.
"We have flown far,"
another said.
"Do you have spice for us, dancer?"
"Salt,"
said another.
"Pepper,"
asked a third.
"Saffron,"
sighed a fourth.
"Give us spice, and we will show you secret ways. Around the tarn, around the inn."
"Oh-ho," Lirianne grinned. "What inn is this? I think I smell it. A magical place, is it?"
"A dark place,"
one twig man said.
"The sun is going out. All the world is growing dark."
Lirianne remembered another inn from another time, a modest place but friendly, with clean rushes on the floor and a dog asleep before the hearth. The world had been dying even then, and the nights were dark and full of terrors, but within those walls it had still been possible to find fellowship, good cheer, even love. Lirianne remembered roasts turning above the crackling fire, the way the fat would spit as it dripped down into the flames. She remembered the beer, dark and heady, smelling of hops. She remembered a girl, too, an innkeeper's daughter with bright eyes and a silly smile, who'd loved a wandering wayfarer. Dead now, poor thing. But what of it? The world was almost dead as well.
"I want to see this inn," she said. "How far is it?"
"A league,"
the twig man said.
"Less,"
a second insisted.
"Where is our salt?"
the two of them said together. Lirianne gave them each a pinch of salt from the pouch at her belt.
"Show me," she said, "and you shall have pepper, too."
The tarnhouse did not lack for custom. Here sat a white-haired man with a long beard spooning up some vile purple stew. There lounged a dark-haired slattern, nursing her glass of wine as if it were a newborn babe. Near the wooden casks that lined one wall, a ferret-faced man with scruffy whiskers was sucking snails out of their shells. Though his eyes struck Chimwazzle as sly and sinister, the buttons on his vest were silver, and his hat sported a fan of peacock feathers, suggesting that he did not lack for means. Closer to the hearth fire, a man and wife crowded around a table with their two large and lumpish sons, sharing a huge meat pie. From the look of them, they had wandered here from some land where the only color was brown. The father sported a thick beard, his sons displayed bushy mustaches that covered their mouths. Their mother's mustache was finer, allowing one to see her lips. The rustics stank of cabbage. so Chimwazel hied to the far side of the room and joined the prosperous fellow with the silver buttons on his vest.
"How are your snails?"
he inquired.
"Slimy and without savor. I do not recommend them."
Chimwazel pulled out a chair.
"I am the great Chimwazel."
"And I, Prince Rokalo the Redoubtable."
Chimwazel frowned.
"Prince of what?"
"Just so."
The prince sucked another snail and dropped the empty shell onto the floor. That answer did not please him.
"The great Chimwazel is no man to trifle with,"
he warned the so-called princeling.
"Yet here you sit in the Tarn House."
"With you,"
observed Chimwazel somewhat peevishly. The landlord made his appearance, bowing and scraping as was appropriate for one of his station.
"How may I serve you?" "I will try a dish of your famous hissing eels."
The innkeep gave an apologetic cough.
"Alas, the eels are, off the bill of fare." "What? How so? Your sign suggests that hissing eels are the specialty of the house."
"And so they were in other days. Delicious creatures, but mischievous. One ate a wizard's concubine, and the wizard was so wroth he set the tarn to boiling and extinguished all the rest."
"Perhaps you should change the sign."
"Every day I think the same when I awaken. But then I think, the world may end today. Should I spend my final hours perched upon a ladder with a paintbrush in my hand? I pour myself some wine and sit down to cogitate upon the matter, and by evening I find the urge has passed."
"Your urges do not concern me," said Chimwazel. "Since you have no eels, I must settle for a roast fowl, well crisped."
The innkeep looked lachrymose.
"Alas, this clime is not salubrious for chicken."
"Fish?"
"From the tarn?"
the man shuddered.
"I would advise against it. Most unwholesome, those waters."
Chimwazel was growing vexed. His companion leaned across the table and said,
"On no account should you attempt a bowl of scrumby. The gristle pies are also to be avoided."
"Begging your pardon," said the landlord, "but meat pies is all we have just now."
"What sort of meat is in these pies?"
asked Chimwazel.
"Brown," said the landlord, "and chunks of gray."
"The meat pie, then."
There seemed to be no help for it. The pie was large, admittedly. That was the best that could be said for it. What meat Chimwazel found was chiefly gristle, here and there a chunk of yellow fat, and once something that crunched suspiciously when he bit into it. There was more gray meat than brown, and once a chunk that glistened green. He found a carrot, too, or perhaps it was a finger. In either case, it had been overcooked. Of the crust, the less said, the better. Finally, Chimwazel pushed the pie away from him. No more than a quarter had been consumed.
"A wiser man might have heeded my warnings," said Rokalo.
"A wiser man with a fuller belly, perhaps."
"That was problem with Twick men. No matter how many you ate, an hour later you were hungry again."
"The earth is old, but the night is young."
The great Chimwazel produced a pack of painted placards from his sleeve.
"Have you played Peggotty? A jolly game that goes well with ale. Perhaps you will essay a few rounds with me?"
"The game is unfamiliar to me, but I am quick to learn," said Rokalo. "If you will explain the rudiments, I should be glad to try my hand."
Chimwazel shuffled the placards. The inn was grander than Lirian had expected, and seemed queer and out of place. Not at all the sort of establishment she would have expected to find along a forest road in the land of the Falling Wall.
"Famous for our hissing eels,"
she read aloud, and laughed. Behind the inn, a sliver of the setting sun floated red upon the black waters of the tarn. The Twick men buzzed around her on their dragonflies. More and more had joined Lirian as she made her way along the road. 2 score, 4, 100. By now she had lost count. The gauzy wings of their mounts trilled against the evening air. The purple dusk hummed to the sound of small, angry voices. Lirianne pinched her nose and took a sniff. The scent of sorcery was so strong it almost made her sneeze. There was magic here.
"Aho," she said. "I smell wizard."
Whistling a sprightly tune, she sauntered closer. A ramshackle cart was drawn up near the bottom of the steps. Slumped against one of its wheels was a huge, ugly man, big-bellied and ripe, with coarse, dark hair sprouting from his ears and nostrils. He looked up as Lirianne approached.
"I would not go up there if I were you. It is a bad place. Men go in, no men come out."
"Well, I am no man, as you can plainly see, and I love bad places. Who might you be?"
"Polymumpho is my name. I am a pooner."
"I am not familiar with pooners."
"Few are."
He shrugged a massive rippling of his shoulders.
"Are those your twig men? Tell them my master went inside to the inn to hide."
"Master?"
3 years ago, I played at Peggotty with Chimwazzle. When my coin ran out, I bet myself."
"Is your master a sorcerer?"
Another shrug.
"He thinks he is."
Lirianne touched the hilt of Tickle Me Sweet.
"Then you may consider yourself free. I shall make good your debt for you."
"Truly?"
He got to his feet.
"Can I have the cart?"
"If you wish."
A wide grin split his face.
"Hop on, and I will carry you to Cain. You will be safe, I promise you. Pooners only eat the flesh of men when the stars are in alignment."
Lirianne glanced up. Half a dozen stars were visible above the trees, dusty diamonds glimmering in a purple velvet sky.
"And who will be the judge of whether the stars are properly aligned for such a feast or no?"
"On that account, you may place your trust in me."
She giggled.
"No, I think not. I am for the inn."
"And I for the road."
The pooner lifted the traces of the cart.
"If Chimwazzle complains of my absence, tell him that my debt is yours."
"I shall."
Lirianne watched as Polymumpho rumbled off toward Cain, the empty cart bouncing and jouncing behind him. She scampered up the winding stone steps and pushed her way through the door into the tarn house. The common room smelled of mold and smoke and ghouls, and a little leucomorph as well, though none such were presently in evidence. One table was packed with hairy rustics, another occupied by a big-bosomed slattern sipping wine from a dinted silver goblet, an old man attired in the antique fashion of a knight of ancient Thorsingol sat lonely and forlorn, his long white beard spotted with purple soup stains. Chimwazzle was not hard to find. He sat behind the ale casks with another rogue, each of them appearing more unsavory than the other. The latter had the stink of rat about him. The former smelled of toad. The radish man wore a gray leather vest with sparkling silver buttons over a tight-fitting shirt striped in cream and azure, with large puffy sleeves. On his pointed head perched a wide-brimmed blue hat decorated with a fan of peacock feathers. His toadish companion, beset by drooping jowls, pebbled skin, and greenish flesh that made him look faintly nauseated, favored a floppy hat that resembled a deflated mushroom, a soiled mauve tunic with golden scrollwork at collar, sleeve, and hem, and green shoes turned up at the toe. His lips were full and fat, his mouth so wide it all but touched the pendulous lobes of his ears. Both vagabonds eyed Lirianne lasciviously as they weighed the possibilities of erotic dalliance. The toad actually dared to venture a small smile. Lirianne knew how that game was played. She removed her hat, bowed to them, and approached their table. A spread of painted placards covered its rough wooden surface, beside the remains of a congealed and singularly unappetizing meat pie.
"What game is this?"
she asked, oh so innocent.
"Peggotty," said the toadish man. "Do you know it?"
"No," she said, "but I love to play. Will you teach me?"
"Gladly. Have a seat. I am Chimwazel, oft called the Gallant. My friend is known as Rokalo the Reluctant.
Redoubtable, the rat-faced man corrected. And I am Prince Rokalo, if it please you. The landlord is about here somewhere. Will you take a drink, girl?
I will, she said. Are you wizards? You have a sorcerous look about you.
Chimwazel made a dismissive gesture.
Such pretty eyes you have, and sharp as well. I know a spell or two.
A charm to make milk sour? Suggested Rokalo. That is a spell that many know, though it takes 6 days to work.
That and many more, boasted Chimwazel, each more potent than the last.
Would you show me? Lirianne asked in a breathless voice.
Perhaps when we know each other better.
Oh, please, I have always wanted to see true magic.
Magic adds spice to the gristle that is life, proclaimed Chimwazel, leering. But I do not care to waste my wonderments before such lumpkins and pooners as surround us. Later, when we are alone, I shall perform such magics for you as you have never seen, until you cry out in joy and awe. But first some ale, and a hand or three of Peggotty to get our juices flowing. What stakes shall we play for?
Oh, I am sure you will think of something, said Lirianne.
By the time Malakos the Melancholy caught sight of the Tarn House, the swollen sun was setting, easing itself down in the west like an old fat man, lowering himself into his favorite chair. Muttering softly in a tongue no living man had spoken since the gray sorcerers went to the stars, the sorcerer commanded a halt. The inn beside the tarn was most inviting to the casual glance, but Malakos was of a suspicious cast, and had long ago learned that things were not always as they seemed. He muttered a brief invocation and lifted up an ebon staff. Atop the staff was a crystal orb, within which a great golden eye looked this way and that. No spell nor illusion could deceive the true-seeing eye. Stripped of its glamour, the tarn house stood weathered and gray, 3 stories tall and oddly narrow. It leaned sideways like a drunken Wurminger, a crooked flight of flagstone steps leading upward to its door. Diamond-shaped panes of green glass gave the light from within a diseased and leprous cast. Its roof was overgrown with drooping ropes of fungus. Behind the inn, the tarn was black as pitch and redolent of decay, dotted with drowned trees, its dark, oily waters stirring ominously. A stable stood off to one side, a structure so decayed that even dead Diadans might balk at entering. At the foot of the inn's steps was a sign that read, Tarn House, famous for our hissing eels. The right front Diadan spoke up.
The earth is dying and soon the sun will fail. Here beneath this rotten roof is a fit abode for Malakos to spend eternity.
The earth is dying and soon the sun shall fail, Malakos agreed. But if the end should overtake us here, I shall spend eternity seated by a fire savoring a dish of hissing eels, whilst you stand shivering in the dark and cold, watching pieces of your body ripen and rot and tumble to the ground. Adjusting the drape of his cloak of fearful mien, he gathered up his tall ebony staff, descended from the palanquin, stepped into the weed-choked yard, and began to climb the steps up to the inn. Above, a door banged open. A man emerged, a small and servile creature with gravy spatters on his apron, who could only be the innkeeper. As he hurried down, wiping his hands upon his apron, he caught his first good sight of Malakos and paled. As well he might. White as bone was the flesh of Malakos, beneath his cloak of fearful mien. Deep and dark and full of sadness were his eyes. His nose curved downward in a hook. His lips were thin and rather dour, his hands large, expressive, long-fingered. On his right hand, his fingernails were painted black, on his left, scarlet. His long legs were clothed in striped pantaloons of those same colors, tucked into calf-high boots of polished grew hide.
Black and scarlet was his hair as well, blood and night mixed together. On his head perched a wide-brimmed hat of purple velvet, decorated with a green pearl and a white quill.
"Dread sir,"
the innkeeper said,
those deodands
will not trouble you. Death diminishes even such savage appetites as theirs.
We do not oft see sorcerers at the Tarn House.
Malikos was unsurprised. Once the dying earth had teemed with such, but in these last days even magic was waning. Spells seemed less potent than before, their very words harder to grasp and hold. The grimoires themselves were crumbling, falling to dust in ancient libraries as their protective charms winked out like guttering candles. As the magic failed, so too did the magicians. Some fell to their own servants, the demons and sandestins, who once obeyed their every whim. Others were hunted down by shadow swords, or torn apart by angry mobs of women. The wisest slipped away to other times and other places, their vast and drafty manses vanishing like mist before the sunrise. Their very names had become the stuff of legend. Mazirian the magician, Turgeon of Myr, Rialto the marvelous, the enigmatic Mumph, Gilgad, Pandalum, Idolfans the preceptor. Yet Malikos remained, and it was his intent to go on remaining, to live to drink a final cup of wine while he watched the sun go out. You stand in the presence of Malikos the Melancholy, poet, philosopher, archmage, and necromancer, a student of forgotten tongues and bane of demonkind, he informed the cringing landlord. Every corner of this dying earth is known to me. I collect curious artifacts from eons past, translate crumbling scrolls no other man can read, converse with the dead, delight the living, frighten the meek, and awe the unenlightened. My vengeance is a cold black wind, my affection warm as a yellow sun. The rules and laws that govern lesser men I brush off as a wayfarer might brush the dust from his cloak. This night I will honor you with my custom. No obsequies are necessary. I will require your best room, dry and spacious, and a feather mattress. I shall sup with you as well. A thick slice of wild boar would fill me nicely with such side dishes as your kitchen may supply.
We have no boars hereabouts, wild or tame. The grues and the herbs ate most of them, and the rest were dragged down into the tarn. I can serve you a meat pie or a piping hot bowl of purple scrumby, but I don't think you'd like the one, and I know you'd hate t'other.
The innkeep swallowed.
1,000 pardons, dread sir. My humble house is not fit for such as you. No doubt you would find some other inn more comfortable.
Malikos let his visage darken.
No doubt, he said, but as no other inn presents itself, I must make do with yours.
The innkeep dabbed at his forehead with his apron.
Dread sir, begging your pardons and meaning no offense, but I've some trouble from sorcerous folk before. Some, not so honest as you, settle their accounts with purses of ensorcelled stones and chunks of dung glamoured to look like gold, and others have been known to inflict boils and warts on unhappy serving wenches and innocent innkeepers when the service does not meet their standards.
The remedy is simple, declared Malikos the Melancholy. See that the service is all that it should be, and you will have no difficulties. You have my word. I will perform no sorceries in your common room, inflict no boils nor warts upon your staff, nor settle my account with dung. But now I grow weary of this banter. The day is done, the sun is fled, and I am weary. So here I mean to stay the night. Your choice is simple. Accommodate me, or else I shall pronounce Gargu's festering reek upon you and leave you to choke upon your own stench until the end of your days, which will not be long in coming, as pelgrains and herbs are drawn to the smell as mice are drawn to a nice ripe cheese. The innkeep's mouth opened and closed, but no words emerged. After a moment, he shuffled to one side. Malikos acknowledged the surrender with a nod, ascended the rest of the steps, and shoved through the inn's front door. The interior of the tarn house proved to be just as dark, damp, and dismal as the exterior. A queer, sour odor hung in the air, though Malikos would not have ventured to say whether it emanated from the innkeep, the other customers, or whatever was cooking in the kitchen. A hush fell upon the common room at his entrance. All eyes turned toward him, as was only to be expected. In his cloak of fearful mien, he was a dreadful sight. Malikos took a seat at the table by the window. Only then did he permit himself to inspect his fellow guests. The group near the fire, growling at each other in low, guttural voices, reminded the sorcerer of turnips with hair. Over by the ale casks, a pretty young girl was laughing and flirting with a pair of obvious scoundrels, one of whom appeared to be not entirely human. Nearby, an old man slept, his head on the table, pillowed atop his folded arms. There was a woman just beyond him, sloshing the dregs of her wine and eyeing the wizard speculatively across the room. A glance was enough to tell Malikos that she was a woman of the evening, though in her case evening was edging on toward night. Her visage was not altogether hideous, although there was something odd and unsettling about the look of her ears. Still, she had a pleasing shape. Her eyes were large and dark and liquid, and the fire woke red highlights in her long black hair. Or so it seemed through the eyes that Malikos had been born with, but he knew better than to put his trust in those. Softly, softly, he whispered an invocation and looked again through the enchanted golden eye atop his staff. This time he saw it true. For his supper, the sorcerer ordered a meat pie, as the specialty of the house was unavailable. After one bite, Malikos put down his spoon, feeling even more melancholy than he had a moment before. Wisps of steam rose through the pie's broken crust to form hideous faces in the air, their mouths open in torment. When the landlord returned to inquire if the repast was to his liking, Malikos gave him a reproachful look and said, "You are fortunate that I am not so quick to wrath as most of my brethren."
"I am grateful for your forbearance, dread sir."
"Let us hope that your bedchambers keep to a higher standard than your kitchen."
"For 3 terses you can share the big bed with Mumpo and his family," the landlord said, indicating the rustics near the hearth. "A private room will cost you 12.
"None but the best for Malikos the melancholy."
"Our best room rents for 20 terses, and is presently occupied by Prince Rakalo."
"Remove his things at once, and have the room readied for me," Malikos commanded. He might have said a good deal more, but just then the dark-eyed woman rose and came over to his table. He nodded toward the chair across from him. "Sit," she said.
"Why do you look so sad?"
"It is the lot of man. I look at you and see the child that you were. Once you had a mother who held you to her breast. Once you had a father who dandled you upon his knee. You were their pretty little girl, and through your eyes they saw again the wonders of the world. Now they are dead, and the world is dying, and their child sells her sadness to strangers."
"We are strangers now, but we need not remain so," the woman said. "My name is—"
"No concern of mine. Are you a child still, to speak your true name to a sorcerer?"
"Sage counsel." She put her hand upon his sleeve. "Do you have a room? Let us repair upstairs, and I will make you happy."
"Unlikely. The earth is dying. So too the race of men. No erotic act can change that, no matter how perverse or energetic."
"There is still hope," the woman said, "for you, for me, for all of us. Only last year I lay with a man who said a child had been born to a woman of Saskavoy."
"He lied,
or was deceived. At Saskavoy the women weep as elsewhere, and devour their children in the womb.
Man dwindles and soon shall disappear. The earth will become the haunt of Diadans and Pelgranes and worse things, until the last light flickers out. There was no child, nor will there be. The woman shivered. Still, she said, still, so long as men and women endure, we must try. Try with me.
As you wish.
He was Molokos, the melancholy, and he had seen her for what she was. When I retire, you may come to my bedchamber, and we shall try the truth of things.
The placards were made of dark black wood, sliced paper thin, and brightly painted. They made a faint clacking sound when Lirianne turned them over. The game was simple enough. They played for terces. Lirianne won more than she lost, though she did not fail to note that whenever the wagering was heavy, somehow Chimwazel showed the brightest placards, no matter how promising her own hand had seemed at first.
"Fortune favors you this evening," Chimwazel announced after a dozen hands, "but playing for such small stakes grows tiresome."
He placed the golden centum on the table.
"Who will meet my wager?" "I,"
said Rocallo.
"The earth is dying, and with it, all of us. What do a few coins matter to a corpse?"
Lirianne looked sad.
"I have no gold to wager."
"No matter," said Chimwazel. "I have taken a fancy to your hat. Put that in the wager against our gold."
"Oh-ho! Is that the way of it?"
She cocked her head and ran the tip of her tongue across her lip.
"Why not?"
Shortly she was hatless, which was no more than she had expected. She handed the prize to Chimwazel with a flourish and shook out her hair, smiling as he stared at her. Lirianne took care never to look directly at the sorcerer seated by the window, but she had been aware of him since the moment he had entered. Gaunt and grim and fearsome, that one, and he stank of sorcery so strongly that it overwhelmed the lesser magics wafting off the odious fraud Chimwazel. Most of the great mages were dead, or fled, slain by shadow swords or gone to some underworld or overworld, or perhaps to distant stars. Those few who remained upon the dying earth were gathering at Cain, she knew, hoping to find safety there behind the white-walled city's ancient enchantments. This was surely one of them. Her palm itched, and Tickle Me Sweet sang silent by her side. Lirianne had tempered its steel in the blood of the first wizard she had slain, when she was 6 and 10. No protective spell was proof against such a blade, though she herself had no defense but her wits. The hard part of killing wizards was knowing when to do it, since most of them could turn you into dust with a few well-chosen words. A round of ales arrived, and then another. Lirianne sipped at her first tankard while her second sat untouched by her elbow, but her companions drank deep. When Rocallo called for a third round, Chimwazel excused himself to answer a call of nature, and loped across the common room in search of a privy. He gave the necromancer's table a wide berth. Lirianne did not fail to notice. That pale, grim creature seemed deeply engrossed in conversation with the inn's resident doxy, oblivious to the wattled, pop-eyed rogue scuttling past. But the golden eye atop his wizard staff had fixed on Chimwazel and watched his every move.
"Chimwazel has been cozening us," she told Rocallo when the toad-faced creature was gone. "I won the last showing, and you the two before that. Yet his pile of terces is as large as ever. The coins move whenever we're not looking, creeping home across the table. And the placards change their faces."
The prince gave a shrug.
"What does it matter? The sun grows dark. Who shall count our terces when we're dead?"
His ennui annoyed her.
"What sort of prince sits by and lets some feeble wizard make a fool of him?"
"The sort who has experienced Lugweiler's dismal itch and has no desire to experience it again. Chimwazel amuses me."
"It would amuse me to tickle Chimwazel."
"He will laugh and laugh, I have no doubt."
Then a shadow fell across them. Lirianne looked up to find the grim-visaged necromancer looming over them. It has been 300 years since I last played a hand of Peggotty, he intoned in a sepulchral tone. May I sit in? The great Chimwazzle's stomach was a heave. The meat pie might be to blame, all that gristle and suet, or perhaps it was the twickmen he had eaten in the woods. Delicious little things, but never easy to digest. They might be in his belly still, stabbing at him with their silly little spears. He should have stopped at a dozen, but once he had started, it was so easy to think, well, one more would be nice, and perhaps another after that one. He wondered if their spears were poisoned. Chimwazzle had not considered that. It was a disagreeable thought. Almost as disagreeable as this inn. He should have paid more heed to the pooner. The Tarn House had little to recommend it, save perhaps the pretty freckly thing who had joined his little game of Peggotty. Already he had won her hat. Her boots would soon follow, and then her stockings. Chimwazzle was only waiting for some of the other travelers in the common room to retire to their beds before beginning his assault in earnest. Roccalo was too dull and diffident to interfere, he was certain. Once he'd won her clothes, the girl would have nothing to wager but her indenture, and afterward he could harness her to his cart an arm's length ahead of Polymumpho. Let the pooner chase after her henceforth. That should serve to keep those hairy legs of his pumping briskly. Chimwazzle might not even need to ply the whip. The inn's privy was cramped and smelly, and offered neither bench nor bar, but only a ragged hole in the floor. Squatting over it with his breeches round his ankles, Chimwazzle grunted and groaned as he voided his bowels. The act was never a pleasant one for him, attended as it was by the risk of waking the imp nested in the fleshier portions of his nether parts, whose second favorite amusement was loudly describing Chimwazzle's manhood in terms of withering scorn. Its first favorite amusement was something Chimwazzle did not wish to think about. He was spared that ordeal on this occasion, but worse awaited him, when he returned to the inn's common room and found that the tall magician with the fearsome face had taken a seat at his own table. Chimwazzle had had enough experiences with great sorcerers to know that he did not want any more such experiences. His present appearance was the legacy of a misunderstanding at a crossroads with one such, and the imp with the loquacious mouth hidden in his breeches was a souvenir left him by the witch Aluuna, whose affections he had enjoyed for a fortnight when he was young and slim and handsome. This sorcerer in scarlet and black lacked Eleuna's charms, but might well share her fickle temper. One never knew what small gaffes and innocent omissions a wizard might take for mortal insult. Still, there was no help for it, unless he meant to flee at once into the night. That course seemed less than advisable. The knights belonged to grues and ghouls and leucomorphs, and there was some small chance more twickmen might be awaiting him as well. So Chimwazzle donned his best smile, resumed his seat, and smacked his lips.
Oh, you have another player, I see. Innkeep, run fetch some ale for our new friend, and be quick about it, or you may find a carbuncle growing on the end of your nose.
I am Malakos the Melancholy, and I do not drink ale.
I perceive you are of the sorceress persuasion, said Chimwazzle. We have that in common, you and I. How many spells do you carry?
That is none of your concern, warned Malakos.
There now. It was an innocent inquiry between colleagues. I myself am armed with 6 great spells, 9 minor enchantments, and a variety of cantraps.
Chimwazzle shuffled the placards.
My Sandestin awaits without, disguised as a pooner and bound to my cart, yet ready to whisk me off into the sky at my command. But no sorcery at table, please. Here Dame Fortune rules and may not be confounded by spells.
And so saying, he placed a golden centum in the center of the table.
Come, come, put in your stakes. Peggotty has more savor when gold is glinting in the pot.
Just so, Prince Roccalo laid his centum atop Chimwazzle's. The girl, Lirianne, could only pout which she did very prettily. I have no gold, and I want my hat back.
Then you must put your boots into the wager.
Must I?
Oh, very well.
The sorcerer said nothing. Instead of reaching into his own purse, he rapped thrice upon the floor with his ebon staff, and pronounced a small cantrip for the dispelling of illusions and concealments. At once, Chimwazzle sent him transformed into a fat white spider, and walked slowly from the board on 8 hairy legs, while the pile of tierces in front of him turned into as many cockroaches and scuttled off in all directions. The girl squealed. The prince chortled. Chimwazzle gulped down his dismay and drew himself up, his jowls a-quiver.
"Look what you have done! You owe me a golden centum."
"Far be it," Malikos said with outrage. "You aspire to hoodwink us with a cheap conjurer's glamour. Do you truly believe such a feeble ploy would work upon Malikos the Melancholy?"
The great golden eye atop his staff was blinking, as green vapors swirled ominously within its crystal orb.
"Softly, softly," protested Prince Rocallo. "My head is hazy from the ale, and harsh words make it ring."
"Oh, will you fight a wizard's duel?"
Lirianne clapped her hands together.
"What grand magics shall we see?"
"The innkeep may protest," said Rocallo. "Such contests are the bane of hospitality. When swordsmen duel, the only damage is some broken crockery and perchance a bloodstain on the floorboards. A pail of hot water and a good elbow will set that aright. A wizard's duel is like to leave an inn a smoking ruin."
"Ha!"
said Chimwazzle, jowls quivering. A dozen rejoinders sprang to his lips, each more withering than the one before, but caution bid him swallow every syllable. Instead, he jerked to his feet so quickly that it sent his chair crashing to the floor.
"The innkeep need have no fear on that account. Such spells as I command are far too potent to be deployed for the idle amusement of hatless trollops and feigned princes. The great Chimwazzle will not be mocked, I warn you."
And so saying, he made a hasty retreat, before the scarlet and black sorcerer could take further umbrage. A fat white spider and a line of cockroaches scuttled after him as fast as their legs would carry them. The fire had burned down to embers, and the air was growing cold. Darkness gathered in the corners of the common room. The rustics by the hearth huddled closer, muttering at one another through their whiskers. The golden eye atop the staff of Malikos, the Melancholy, peered this way and that.
"Do you mean to let the cheat escape?"
the girl asked. Malikos did not deign to answer. Soon all the veils would fall away, he sensed. The fraud Chimwazzle was the least of his concerns. The shadow swords were here, and worse things, too, and it seemed to him that he could hear a faint, soft hissing. The landlord rescued him from further inquiry, appearing suddenly by his elbow to announce that his room was ready should he wish to retire.
"I do."
Malikos rose to his feet, leaning on his staff. He adjusted his cloak of fearful mien and said,
"Show me."
The innkeep took a lantern off the wall, lit the wick, turned up the flame.
"If you would follow me, dread sir."
Up 3 long flights of crooked steps, Malikos climbed, following the landlord with his lantern, until at last they reached the upper story and a heavy wooden door. The Tarnhouse's best room was none too grand. The ceiling was too low, and the floorboards creaked alarmingly. A single window looked out across the tarn, where black waters churned and rippled suggestively beneath the dim red light of distant stars. Beside the bed, on a small 3-legged table, a tallow candle stood crookedly in a puddle of hardened wax, flickering. A chest and a straight-backed chair were the only other furnishings. Shadows lay thickly in the corners of the room, black as the belly of a deodand. The air was damp and chill, and Malikos could hear wind whistling through gaps in the shutters.
"Is that mattress stuffed with feathers?" he asked.
"Nothing but honest straw at the Tarnhouse."
The innkeep hung his lantern from a hook.
See, here are two stout planks that slide in place to bar the door and window, so you may rest easy tonight, with no fear of intruders. The chest at the foot of the bed contains an extra blanket and may be used to store your garments and other valuables. Beside it is your chamber pot. Is there anything else you might require?
Only solitude.
As you command.
Malikos listened as the innkeep made his descent. When he was satisfied that he was alone, he gave the room a careful inspection, tapping on the walls, checking the door and window, thumping the floorboards with the butt of his staff. The chest at the foot of the bed had a false bottom that could be opened from beneath to give access to a crawlway. Doubtless that was how the thieves and murderers crept in, to relieve unwary travelers of their goods and lives. As for the bed, Malikos gave the mattress a wide berth, seating himself instead in the chair, his staff in hand. His last few spells were singing in his head. It did not take long for the first of his visitors to arrive. Her knock was soft but insistent. Malikos opened the door, ushered her into the bedchamber, and slid the bar in place behind her.
"So we are not disturbed," he explained.
The dark-haired woman smiled seductively. She pulled the ties that closed her robe, then shrugged it off her shoulders to puddle on the floor.
"Will you remove your cloak?"
"As soon remove my skin," said Malikos, the melancholy. The woman shivered in his arms.
"You talk so strangely. You frighten me."
Goose prickles covered her arms.
"What do you have in your hand?"
"Surcease."
He stabbed her through the throat. She sank to her knees, hissing. When her mouth opened, her fangs gleamed in the half-light, long and pointed. Her blood ran black down her neck. A leucomorph, he judged, or something stranger still. The wilds were full of queer things now, mongrels fathered by demons on diadans, spawn of succubi and incubi, mock men grown in vats, bog-born monsters made of rotting flesh. Bending over her pale corpse, Malikos the melancholy brushed her hair back from her cheek and kissed her, once upon the brow, once upon each cheek, deeply on the mouth. Life left her with a shudder and entered him with a gasp as warm as a summer wind in the days of his youth, when the sun burned brighter and laughter could still be heard in the cities of men. When she was cold, he spoke the words of Kazul's indenture, and her corpse opened its eyes again. He bid her rise, to stand sentry while he slept. A great weariness was on him, but it would not do to be taken unawares. He would have other visitors before the night was done, he did not doubt. He dreamt of Cain, shimmering behind its high white walls. A chill hung in the night air as Chimwazel slipped from the inn through a side door. A gray mist was rising off the tarn, and he could hear the waters stirring down below, as if something were moving in the shallows. Crouching low, he peered this way and that, his bulbous eyes moving beneath his floppy cap, but he saw no sign of Quickmen, nor did he hear the soft, ominous trill of dragonfly wings. They had not found him, then. That was good. It was time he was away. That there were grues and ghouls and herbs out in the wood he did not doubt, but he would sooner take his chances with them than with the necromancer. A few brisk licks of the whip and his pooner would outrace them all. And if not, well, Palamumfo had more meat on him than Chimwazel. Grinning ear to ear, he loped down the rocky hummock, his belly wobbling. Halfway down, he noticed that his cart was gone.
"Infamous pooner," he cried, stumbling in shock. "Thief! Thief! Where is my cart, you lice-ridden lump?"
No one gave reply. At the foot of the steps there was nothing to be seen but a sinister iron palanquin and four huge diadans with flesh as black as night standing knee-deep in the tarn. The waters were rising, Chimwazel realized suddenly. The tarn house had become an island. Fury pushed aside his fear. Diadans relished the taste of man flesh, it was known.
"Did you eat my pooner?"
he demanded.
"No,"
said one, showing a mouthful of gleaming ivory teeth.
"But come closer and we will gladly eat you."
"Ha!" said Chimwazel. Now that he was closer, he could see that the Diadans were dead. The necromancer's work, he did not doubt. He licked his earlobe nervously, and a cunning ploy occurred to him.
"Your master Malikos has commanded you to carry me to Cain with all haste."
"Yes,"
hissed the Diadand.
"Malikos commands, and we obey. Come, clamber on, and we'll away."
Something about the way he said that made Chimwazel pause to reconsider the wisdom of his plan. Or perhaps it was the way all four of the Diadans began to gnash those pointed teeth. He hesitated and suddenly grew aware of a faint stirring in the air behind him, a whisper of wind at the back of his neck. Chimwazel whirled. A trick man was floating a foot from his face, his lance couched, and a dozen more hovering behind him. His bulging eyes popped out even further as he saw the upper stories of the Tarn House a-crawl with them, thick as tasps and twice as verminous. Their dragonflies were a glowing green cloud roiling like a thunderhead.
"Now you perish,"
the trick man said. Chimwazel's sticky tongue struck first, flicking out to pull the small green warrior from his mount. But as he crunched and swallowed, the cloud took wing, buzzing angrily. Yelping in dismay, the great Chimwazel had no choice but to flee back up the steps to the inn, hotly pursued by a swarm of dragonflies and the laughter of a Diadand. Lirianne was vexed. It would have been so much easier if only she could have set the two wizards to fighting over her, so they might exhaust their magic on one another. That the ghastly Malikos would make short work of the odious Chimwazel she did not doubt, but however many spells that might have required would have left him with that many fewer when the time came for her to tickle him. Instead, Malikos had retired to his bed, while Chimwazel had scuttled off into the night, craven as a crab. "Look at what he did to my hat," Lirianne complained, snatching it off the floorboards. Chimwazel had trampled on it in his haste to depart, and the feather was broken.
"His hat," said Prince Rocallo. "You lost it."
"Yes, but I meant to win it back, though I suppose I should be grateful that it did not turn into a cockroach." She jammed the hat back on her head, tilted at a rakish angle. "First they break the world, and then my hat."
"Chimwazel broke the world?"
"Him," Lirianne said darkly, "and his sort. Wizards, sorcerers and sorceresses, sages and mages and archmages, witches and warlocks, conjurers, illusionists, diabolists, necromancers, geomancers, aeromancers, pyromancers, thaumaturges, dreamwalkers, dream weavers, dream eaters, all of them. Their sins are written on the sky, dark as the sun."
"You blame black magic for the world's demise?"
"Bah," said Lirianne. "Men were such fools. White magic and black are two sides of the same terse. The ancient tomes tell the tale, for those who have the wit to read them correctly. Once there was no magic. The sky was bright blue, the sun shone warm and yellow. The woods were full of deer and hare and songbirds, and everywhere the race of man was thriving. Those ancient men built towers of glass and steel taller than mountains, and ships with sails of fire that took them to the stars. Where are those glories now? Gone, lost, forgotten. Instead we have spells, charms, curses. The air grows cold, the woods are full of grue and ghouls, Diadans haunt the ruins of ancient cities, Pelgrains rule the skies where men once flew. Whose work is this? Wizards. Their magic is a blight on sun and soul. Every time a spell is spoken here on earth, the sun grows that much darker. She might have revealed even more had not the pop-eyed Chimwassel chosen that very moment to make a sudden reappearance, stumbling through the door with his long arms wrapped around his head.
"Get them off!"
he bellowed as he lurched between the tables.
"Ow! Ow! Ow! Get off me! I am innocent! It was someone else!"
Thus shouting, he went crashing to the floor, where he writhed and rolled, slapping himself about the head and shoulders, while continuing to implore for assistance against attackers who seemed nowhere in evidence.
"Quick!" he cried. "Quick! Quick! Wretched! Quick! Off me! Off me!"
Prince Rocallo winced.
"Enough, Chimwassel. Cease this unmanly caterwauling. Some of us are attempting to drink."
The rogue rolled onto his rump, which was wide and wobbly and amply padded.
"The twig men!"
"Remain without," said Lirianne.
The door remained wide open, but none of the twig men had followed Chimwassel inside. Chimwassel blinked his bulbous eyes and peered about from side to side to make certain that was true. Although no twig men were to be seen, the back of his neck was covered with festering boils where they had stung him with their lances, and more were sprouting on his cheeks and forehead.
"I do hope you know a healing spell," Rocallo said. "Those look quite nasty. The one on your cheek is leaking blood."
Chimwassel made a noise that was half a groan and half a croak, and said,
"Vile creatures! They're no cause to abuse me thus. All I did was thin their excess populace. There were plenty left."
Puffing, he climbed back onto his feet and retrieved his cap.
"Where is that pestilential innkeep? I require urgent at once. These pinpricks have begun to itch."
"Itching is only the first symptom," said Lirianne with a helpful smile. "The lances of the twig men are envenomed. By morning your head will be as large as a pumpkin. Your tongue will blacken and burst, your ears will fill with pus, and you may be seized by an irresistible desire to copulate with a hoon."
"A hoon?"
croaked Chimwassel, appalled.
"Perhaps a grue. It depends upon the poison."
Chimwassel's face had turned a deeper shade of green.
"This affront cannot be borne. Pus? Hoons? Is there no cure, no salve, no antidote?"
Lirianne cocked her head to one side thoughtfully.
"Why," she said, "I have heard it said that the blood of a sorcerer is a sure remedy for any bane or toxin."
Chimwassel went creeping up the stairs with his companions padding quietly at his heels. Lirianne had her sword, and Prince Rocallo a dagger. Chimwassel had only his hands, but those hands were damp and soft and hideously strong. Whether they were strong enough to twist a wizard's head off remained to be seen. The steps were steep and narrow and creaked beneath his weight. Chimwassel panted softly as he climbed, his tongue lolling from his mouth. He wondered if Malakos would be asleep yet. He wondered if the sorcerer had thought to bar his door. He wondered why it was that he was going first. But there was no turning back. Lirianne was close behind him, blocking his retreat, and Rocallo came after her, smiling with those pointy yellow teeth. And the boils on his face and neck were itching abominably and growing by the moment. One just beneath his ear had swelled up, large as an egg. A bit of blood was not too much to ask of favor from one magician to another. Alas, Malakos might not see it that way. He did not have Chimwassel's generosity of soul. At the top of the steps, the three conspirators clustered close together outside the sorcerer's door.
"He's in there," said Lirianne, sniffing at the air with her pert little nose. "I can smell his wizard stink."
Rocallo reached out for the latch.
"Gently,"
Chimwassel cautioned in a whisper.
"Oh, soft it goes. Slowly, slowly. It would be discourteous to wake him."
He scratched at a boil on his brow, but that only seemed to make the itching worse.
"The door is barred,"
Rocallo whispered back.
Alas, Chimwazzle said, relieved. Our plan is foiled. Back to the common room, then. Let us reconsider over ale.
He scratched furiously beneath his chin, groaned.
Why not break the door down? Asked Lirianne. A big, strong man like you.
She squeezed his arm and smiled.
Unless you would rather give pleasure to a hoon.
Chimwazzle shuddered, though even a hoon might be preferable to this itching. Glancing up, he saw the transom. It was open just a crack, but that might be enough.
Rokalo, friend, lift me up under your shoulders.
The prince knelt. As you wish. He was stronger than he looked, and seemed to have no trouble hoisting Chimwazzle up into the air, for all his bulk. Nor did the nervous trumpet notes emitted by Chimwazzle's nether parts dismay him unduly. Pressing his nose to the transom, Chimwazzle slid his tongue through the gap and down the inside of the door frame, then curled it thrice around the wooden plank that barred the way. Slowly, slowly, he lifted the bar from its slot. But the weight proved too great for his tongue, and the plank fell clattering to the floor. Chimwazzle reeled backwards. Prince Rokalo lost his balance, and the two of them collapsed atop each other with much grunting and cursing, while Lirianne skipped nimbly aside. Then the door swung open. Malakos the Melancholy did not need to speak a word. Silent he bid them enter, and silent they obeyed, Chimwazzle scrambling over the threshold on hands, on feet, as his fellows stepped nimbly around him. When all of them had come inside, he closed the door behind them and barred it once again. The rogue Chimwazzle was almost unrecognizable beneath his floppy hat, his toadish face a mass of festering boils and buboes where some twig men had kissed him with their lances.
Save!
He croaked, as he climbed unsteadily to his feet.
We came for salve! Sorry to disturb you. Dread sir, if you perchance should have some unguent for itching.
I'm Malakos the Melancholy. I do not deal in unguents. Come here and grasp my staff.
For a moment, Chimwazzle looked as he might bolt the room instead. But in the end he bowed his head and shuffled closer and wrapped the soft, splayed hand around the ebon shaft of the tall sorcerer's staff. Inside the crystal orb, the true-seeing eye had fixed on Lirianne and Rokalo. When Malakos thumped the staff upon the floor, the great golden eye blinked once.
Now look again upon your companions, and tell me what you see.
Chimwazzle's mouth gaped open, and his bulging eyes looked as though they might pop out of his skull.
The girl is cloaked in shadows, he gasped, and under her freckly face I see a skull.
And your prince?
Is a demon.
The thing called Prince Rokalo laughed and let all his enchantments dissolve. His flesh was red and raw, glowing like the surface of the sun, and like the sun, half covered by a creeping black leprosy. Smoke rose stinking from his nostrils, the floorboards began to smolder beneath his taloned feet, and black claws sprang from his hands as long as knives. Then Malakos spoke a word and stamped his staff hard against the floor, and from the shadows in a corner of the room, a woman's corpse came bursting to leap upon the demon's back. As the two of them lurched and staggered about the room, tearing at each other, Lirianne danced aside, and Chimwazzle fell backwards onto his ample rump. The stench of burning flesh filled the air. The demon ripped one of the corpse's arms off and flung it smoking at the head of Malakos, but the dead feel no pain, and her other arm was wrapped about its throat. Black blood ran down her cheeks like tears as she pulled him backward onto the bed. Malakos stamped his staff again. The floor beneath the bed yawned open, the mattress tilted, and demon and corpse together tumbled down into a gaping black abyss. A moment later, there came a loud splash from below, followed by a furious cacophony, demonic shrieking mingled with a terrible whistling and hissing, as if a thousand kettles had all come to a boil at once. When the bed righted itself, the sound diminished, but it was a long while before it ended.
What was that?
Asked Chimwazel.
Hissing eels. The inn is famous for them.
I distinctly recall the innkeep saying that the eels were off the menu, said Chimwazel.
The eels are off our menu, but we not off theirs.
Lirianne made a pouty face and said, The hospitality of the Tarn House leaves much to be desired. Chimwazel was edging toward the door.
I mean to speak firmly to the landlord. Some adjustment of our bill would seem to be in order.
He scratched angrily at his boils.
I would advise against returning to the common room, said the necromancer. No one in the Tarn House is all that he appears. The hirsute family by the hearth are ghouls clad in suits of human skin, here for the meat pies. The graybeard in the faded raiment of a knight of old Thorsengal is a malign spirit, cursed to an eternity of purple scrumby for the niggardly gratuities he left in life. The demon and the leucomorph are no longer a concern, but our servile host is vilest of all. Your wisest course is flight. I suggest you use the window.
The great Chimwazel needed no further encouragement. He hurried to the window, threw the shutters open, and gave a cry of dismay.
The Tarn! I had forgotten! The Tarn has encircled the inn! There's no way out!
Lirianne peered over his shoulder and saw that it was true.
The waters are higher than before, she said thoughtfully.
That was a bother. She had learned to swim before she learned to walk, but the oily waters of the Tarn did not look wholesome, and while she did not doubt that Tickle Me Sweet would be a match for any hissing eel, it was hard to swim and sword fight at the same time. She turned back to the necromancer.
I suppose we're doomed then, unless you save us with a spell.
Which spell would you have me use?
Asked Molokos in a mordant tone.
Shall I summon an agency of far dispatch to whisk us three away to the end of the earth? Call down fire from the sky with the excellent prismatic spray to burn this vile hostelry to the ground? Pronounce the words of Fandale's shivering chill to freeze the waters of the Tarn as hard as stone, so that we may scamper safely over them?
Chimwazel looked up hopefully.
Yes, please.
Which?
Any. The great Chimwazel was not meant to end up in a meat pie.
He scratched a boil underneath his chin.
Surely you know those spells yourself, said Molokos.
I did, said Chimwazel, but some knave stole my grimoire.
Molokos chuckled. It was the saddest sound that Lirianne had ever heard.
It makes no matter. All things die, even magic. Enchantments fade, sorceries unravel, grimoires turn to dust, and even the most puissant spells no longer work as they once did.
Lirianne cocked her head.
Truly?
Truly.
Oh-ho!
She drew her sword and gave his heart a tickle. The necromancer died without a sound, his legs folding slowly under him as if he were kneeling down to pray. When the girl slipped her sword out of his chest, a wisp of scarlet smoke rose from the wound. It smelled of summer nights and maiden's breath, sweet as a first kiss. Chimwazel was aghast.
Why did you do that?
He was a necromancer.
He was our only hope.
You have no hope.
She wiped her blade against her sleeve.
When I was 15, a young adventurer was wounded outside my father's inn. My father was too gentle to let him die there in the dust, so we carried him upstairs and I nursed him back to health. Soon after he departed, I found I was with child. For 7 months my belly swelled, and I dreamed
of a babe with his blue eyes. In my 8th month, the swelling ceased. Thereafter, I grew slimmer with every passing day. The midwife explained it all to me. What use to bring new life into a dying world? My womb was wiser than my heart, she said. And when I asked her why the world was dying, she leaned close and whispered, "Wizard's work."
"Not my work,"
Chimwazel scratched at his cheeks with both hands, half mad with the itching.
"What if she was wrong?"
"Then you'll have died for naught." Lirianne could smell his fear. The scent of sorcery was on him, but faintly, faintly, drowning beneath the green stink of his terror. Truly, this one was a feeble sort of magician.
"Do you hear the eels?" she asked him. "They're still hungry. Would you like a tickle?"
"No."
He backed away from her. His bloody fingers splayed.
"Quicker than being eaten alive by eels."
Tickle Me Sweet waved in the air, glimmering in the candlelight.
"Stay back,"
Chimwazel warned her,
"or I will call down the excellent prismatic spray upon you."
"You might, if you knew it, which you don't, or if it worked, which it won't, if our late friend can be believed."
Chimwazel backed away another step and stumbled over the necromancer's corpse. As he reached out to break his fall, his fingers brushed against the sorcerer's staff. Grasping it, he popped back to his feet.
"Stay away! There's still power in his staff. I warn you, I can feel it."
"That may be, but it is no power you can use."
Lirianne was certain of that. He was hardly half a wizard, this one. Most likely he had stolen those placards and paid to have the roaches glamoured for him. Poor, sad, wicked thing. She resolved to make a quick end to his misery.
"Stand still. Tickle Me Sweet will cure your itch. I promise you this will not hurt."
"This will?"
Chimwazel grasped the wizard's staff with both hands and smashed the crystal orb down on her head. Chimwazel stripped both corpses clean before tossing them down the chute behind the bed, in hopes of quieting the hissing eels. The girl was even prettier naked than she had been clothed, and stirred feebly as he was dragging her across the room.
"Such a waste,"
Chimwazel muttered as he heaved her down into the abyss. Her hat was much too small for him, and had a broken feather, but her sword was forged of fine, strong, springy steel. Her purse was fat with tierces, and the leather of her boots was soft and supple. Too small for his feet, but perhaps one day he'd find another pretty, freckly girl to wear them for him. Even in death, the necromancer presented such a frightful countenance that Chimwazel was almost afraid to touch him. But the eels were still hissing hungrily down below, and he knew his chances of escape would be much improved if they were sated. So he steeled himself, knelt, and undid the clasp that fastened the dread wizard's cloak. When he rolled his body over to pull the garment off, the sorcerer's features ran like black wax, melting away to puddle on the floor. Chimwazel found himself kneeling over a wizened, toothless corpse with dim white eyes and parchment skin, his bald pate covered by a spiderweb of dark blue veins. He weighed no more than a bag of leaves, but he had a little smile on his lips when Chimwazel tossed him down to the hissing eels. By then the itching seemed to be subsiding. Chimwazel gave himself a few last scratches and fastened the necromancer's cloak about his shoulders. All at once he felt taller, harder, sterner. Why should he fear the things down in the common room? Let them go in fear of him. He swept down the steps without a backward glance. The ghosts and ghouls took one look at him and moved aside. Even creatures such as they knew better than to trouble a wizard of such fearsome mien. Only the innkeeper dared accost him.
"Dread sir," he murmured, "how will you settle your account? With this?"
He drew his sword and gave the thing a tickle.
"I will not be recommending the Tarn House to other travelers."
Black waters still encircled the inn, but they were no more than waist deep, and he found it easy enough to wade to solid ground. The trickmen had vanished in the night, and the hissing eels had grown quiescent, but the Diadans still stood where he had seen them last, waiting by the iron palanquin. One greeted him.
"The earth is dying, and soon the sun shall fail,"
it said.
"When the last light fades, all spells shall fail, and we shall feast upon the firm white flesh of Molagos. The earth is dying, but you are dead,"
replied Chimwazel, marveling at the deep and gloomy timbre of his voice.
"When the sun goes out, all spells shall fail, and you shall decay back into the primeval ooze."
He climbed into the palanquin and bid the Diadans to lift him up.
"To Cain!"
Perhaps somewhere in the white-walled city he would find a lissom maid to dance naked for him in the freckly girl's high boots, or failing that, a hoon. Off into purple gloom rode Molokos the Melancholy, borne upon an iron palanquin by four dead Diadans. Afterward. I expect I was about 10 or 11 years old the first time I encountered the work of Jack Vance, when I grabbed one of those ace doubles with the colorful red and blue spines off the spinner rack in the candy store at First Street and Kelly Parkway in Bayonne, New Jersey. Most of the doubles featured two complete novels, today we would call them novellas, by two different writers, published back to back. But this one had the same byline on both sides, pairing Slaves of Clow with an abridged version of Big Planet. Slaves of Clow was pretty good, my 11-year-old self decided after reading it. Big Planet blew me away, even in its abridged state. Thereafter, I looked for Vance's name whenever I set one of those spinner racks to spinning. And so it was that a few years later I stumbled on the Lancer paperback of The Dying Earth. Half a century has passed since then, and that slim little collection remains one of my all-time favorites. Scarcely a year goes by that I do not take it down and dip into it again. The world that Vance created ranks with Tolkien's Middle Earth and Robert E. Howard's Hyborian Age as one of fantasy's most unforgettable and influential settings. The poetry of Vance's language also moved me, not to mention expanding my vocabulary. His dialogue in particular was so arch and dry and witty that I could not read enough of it, then or now. But it was the characters that I loved best, Tsain and Tsace, Guile of Sphere, Turgeon of Myr, and of course, Liane the Wayfarer, whose encounter with Chun the Unavoidable remains perhaps my single favorite fantasy short story. Vance made us wait 16 years between the first Dying Earth book and the second, but by the time Eyes of the Overworld was published, I was accustomed to snatching up every book that had his name on it as soon as it hit the bookshops. To my surprise, this new one was nothing at all like the original. This time, Jack showed us an entirely different side of the world he had created, while introducing us to Kugel the Clever, a rogue so venal and unscrupulous that he makes Harry Flashman look like Dudley Do-Right. How could you not love a guy like that? Other readers shared my enthusiasm, plainly, to judge from the number of times that Kugel has come back. You can't keep a bad man down. By now, I have read every book Jack Vance ever wrote. The science fiction, the fantasies, the mystery novels. Yes, even the ones he wrote as Ellery Queen. All of them are good. But of course I have my favorites. The Demon Princes series, the Planet of Adventure Quartet, Emphyrio, the Leoness Trilogy, the Hugo-winning novellas The Dragon Masters and The Last Castle, the unforgettable Moon Moth. But The Dying Earth and its three sequels still rank up at the top. It has been a real privilege for me to co-edit this tribute anthology with my friend Gardner Dozoy, and even more so to write a Dying Earth story of my own. No one writes like Jack Vance, but Jack Vance, of course. but I cherish the hope that Malakos, Lirian, and Chimwazel may prove not entirely unworthy companions for Rialto, Tsais, Lian, Kugel, and the rest of Jack's unforgettable cast, and that all Jack's myriad readers will have enjoyed their brief stay at the Tarn House, famous for its hissing eels. George R. R. Martin.